All right, it is 7:45, so we'll kick off. Welcome everybody who's watching on Zoom, watching on Facebook. It's great to be with you. I must admit, I haven't been on Zoom in a while. I'm actually liking it that way, but certain things work better on Zoom, so it's good to be together with all of you. This is actually, just to give a little bit of introduction, Bina is trying to move more into the mental health space, a very important space that needs to be spoken about. Obviously, we're going to be doing this from a more Jewish perspective. And we're going to try to do that through various classes, lectures like this one. And we're calling it Project Oz, which means strength. It's all about providing strength to people and to ourselves, that we can strengthen ourselves to have good mental health and good well-being. And this particular series is going to be a three-part series. It's going to be tonight and for the next two Wednesday nights, same time, same Zoom, different guests and different topics as we'll publicize throughout the week, focusing on this very important topic of mental health. So tonight we are privileged to be joined by two amazing people, by Dee Fittinghoff, who's the clinical psychologist, head of psychology and positive education at Moriah College, and as well by Glenn Eisenberg, who's a first responder at Beyond Blue Hotline. So thank you so much, both of you, for joining us and for joining this conversation. I had a great conversation with Dee a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, at Moriah with year 11, and that was great. So I thought we would continue it here. So the way this is going to work, and of course, I forgot my father, Rabbi Gerari, is also joining us tonight.
Hi, everyone.
Of course, I'm just going to be asking questions. And what I'll do is I'll ask a question, I'll point it at somebody, but obviously, all three of you are welcome to answer any question that you think you have something to contribute towards. And if anyone in the crowd has any questions, please put it in the chat and I will. And I'll read it out and we'll endeavor to answer all of your questions. So please make this interactive. Please participate in the conversation. So tonight we're going to be focusing on reaching out and the power of connection, the idea of connecting to others and how that can help our mental health and well-being. So I want to begin with the following question. How bad does it need to be for someone to reach out? And I'll sort of define the question a little bit more. What is normal, quote unquote, normal anxiety and depression, and what is not okay? Meaning, many times we wake up in a bad mood, many times we go through a hard day. Not every time we have a hard day, do we need to call Beyond Blue Hotline or reach out to a professional or to a rabbi or to whoever? So Glenn, I would love you to actually start with this.
Sure.
What type of calls do you get? Who do you think needs to call you? When do you think someone should call you?
Boy, I mean, that's a great question, and I'll make it a broad answer. It really encompasses everyone and anything. Again, like I've been just a little background, I've been doing Beyond Blue for 3 years or so, and I've probably on web chats and calls, and I've probably spoken and chatted to over 1,500 Australians. And they come from a wide range of backgrounds and presentations. Sometimes they are just flooded. I'm sure you've heard that word, where it's just been a week or a day or a situation, and they just cannot contain that anxiety or level of depression anymore. And they just need to reach out to speak to somebody to offload. Because unfortunately, sometimes some of the callers I get don't quite have the same support systems as other people do. So you were just saying that what kind of level does a person reach when they reach out to me? Is that it's look, I it they just get to the point where they're like, I need to be heard, I need to be listened. And as I always preface it, when anybody calls our line, I'm just like, what a great job you're doing. What a brave thing you're able to do right now. You're recognizing that you're at a place that you are unable to cope and settle with yourself now. You're taking a step, you're reaching out, you're talking to a counselor. So I don't want to put any label on to when you should call. You should call us or any service whenever you want at any point. because a lot of this is, look, we all wake up in the morning. The first thing we do, we deal with anxiety or depression or the life experiences or whatever else, past traumas, things that have affected us and led us to that moment. We could wake up overwhelmed every single morning. It's just a fact of interacting with this real world. If it ever gets to the point, though, where you feel like, you know what, I just can't do this anymore. I think I may do something. I'm considering it. Yes, reach out to us. But even if you're not considering it, but you're having a thought or two about it, reach out. Mm-hmm. When you're flooded, you reach out, you connect. There is something to be said to just being heard, listened to, and validated. So doesn't matter your age. Of course, there are stats. Males tend to be more so than women. People in rural communities, poverty, et cetera, has a lot to do with it, but it cuts across the board.
Yeah, definitely. Dee, you work in a school with students. Mm-hmm. What type of students come to you, and when do you advise students to come to you? At what point?
Absolutely. So, Levy, what you're really talking about is the difference between people having some symptoms and where that crosses over, like into a disorder. So for a lot of people, you can have symptoms, as you said earlier, of feeling sad, you know, or that you don't feel as much pleasure in things that used to give you pleasure. If those continue, then they can convert into like a major depressive disorder. But and when I say continue, I'm talking about, you know, they're ongoing for 2 weeks or more, and you know. The same with any kind of symptoms. We all naturally will wake up and have some bad days where, you know, you don't feel so great. That's okay. And so I absolutely agree with Glenn. And one of the things that we teach at school is what we call help seeking behavior. And we teach students that at any time, it's really important to ask for help, to seek help. You don't have to wait until it's a disorder. When you're having some symptoms, or if you're sitting with things, it's important to reach out. And it can be a variety of professionals. It can be a psychologist. It can be at school, a teacher. It can be a safe adult. It can be someone in the community. But we're trying to encourage this help-seeking behavior. And you kind of also said, you know, when should you do this? It's never too late to do it. You know, when I was in private practice, I got referred by a GP, a lady in her 80s. And she had been sitting with stuff her whole entire life. She came into my office and she said to me, Dee, this is like really uncomfortable to me. For me, you know, I was brought up in an age where like you just didn't talk about your feelings and you kind of like just got on with it. And she said, but I'm feeling as if I've got sitting with so many things, I'm feeling physically unwell. And so what can often happen is that you're sitting with all of that emotional stuff. And if you don't have the opportunity to offload it, to talk about it, it can actually create physical, you know, illness for you. And with this particular person, she went on to see me for 2 years and do a lot of work from her childhood. Glenn spoke about trauma from the past. So it's never, ever too late to seek help. And it's never too early. Let's teach kids from when they're really little. If you're feeling like you want to, things aren't going so well, talk to someone.
Well, incredible.
Can I just jump in with like a bit of a rabbi perspective on that? Mm-hmm. and obviously following on from what both Dee and Glenn said, sometimes, you know, also like we talked about people who don't have any symptoms, just it's a bad day or a sad day or whatever the case is, struggling. You know, in Pirkei Avot, in the Ethics of the Fathers, it tells us, Knei aseh lecha rav, a person should have a mentor, and Knei lecha chaver, and a person should have a friend. And the language that it uses is Knei, you should acquire a friend. Now, doesn't necessarily mean literally you should buy a friend, because that's not always a good idea. But it means that there needs to be investment. What I'm saying is that people, I think it's also about, not only about when you reach out, it's also about being a person who's able to reach out. And it could be a very low level reaching out. Now, sometimes a friend is not enough. A professional is clearly needed, or a service is needed. But it's also about not always having to get there. It's about getting used to having, it doesn't have to be broadcasted to the whole world. A person doesn't have to be over needy. But at the same time, a person has to have a friend, two friends, someone that they're close with. And it takes investment in that, building up those kind of relationships where there's someone who you could just offload with, someone you could just share with, someone who you can confide with, someone who knows you well and you know them well, and there's trust between you. Just so it's about, I suppose it's about a continuously kind of reaching out where there's someone you can always communicate with. It could be a spouse, it could be a friend, but it's about getting used to not keeping everything inside, but just being able to share. Even if it's something minor, you don't need to run to a psychologist, but it, just the mere thing that you know how to communicate your feelings and how to communicate something that's troubling you.
Just an interesting follow-up to that that just came to me. You said about sort of sharing things, right? Is it always, we all have people in our life, whether it's a spouse, a friend, sort of a colleague. Is it always good to share? Like, do we always need to burden everyone with our, with you know, our bad day? Or is it sometimes sort of for our relationships, is it sort of damaging if we're always talking about what's bothering us? Or is that not a bad thing?
I'd like to hear the other say, but just, I mean, not everything, yeah. I mean, also we need to be, obviously we need to build resilience and inner strength, and that's a different topic. And, you know, not every time someone looks at us bad, it becomes a whole traumatic experience. But at the same time, you know, there's a very famous verse, I think it's from Mishlei, where it says, "Daga belev ish yas shchena," that when there's a worry in the heart of a person, it says yashchena, and that word in Hebrew has two meanings. One meaning is you should remove it. The other meaning is you should communicate it, like from the word sicha, you should communicate it with someone else. So sometimes the way it works is there's one thing that we cannot do, or we shouldn't do. We shouldn't walk around with something that's bothering us. So if something happens, someone said something you don't like, and you're able to, on your own, just quickly get rid of it, and it really doesn't bother you anymore, then that's fine. You don't have to go around to everyone all the time. But if it's something is sitting on you, then the way to remove it is sometimes to communicate. They go together, you know. So yes, you don't have to become an over needy person, but I think having that relationship with people who you're comfortable to share, and you're comfortable to share with them, is critically important. Does it have to be everything that happens every day? Of course not, but
right. But, do you recommend students talk between themselves about these things? Is that a safe thing to do? Is that
absolutely? Yeah. Because what we're talking about, Levi, what you were talking about earlier, and what Rabbi's talking about also, is authentic, meaningful relationships. How do you build authentic, meaningful relationships? By talking things through, by someone who's got your back. It's not that you always share bad things. You share good things as well. When good things happen, you also want to share those things. But when bad things happen, it's wonderful to have people around you that are there for you, that have got your back, that listen to you, that want the best for you. And in fact, if you want to look at the science behind that in positive psychology, where which is a scientific study of optimal human functioning, one of the major factors of optimal human functioning is strong, healthy, supportive relationships. So we want to encourage people to reach out in all ways, in good, in bad. And definitely when you say, should students reach out to each other? Peer groups, as we know, are very strong, you know, in your teenage years. And that's okay to reach out to peers. What we say to peers is, if it's something that you feel like it's a little bit, you know, like if someone, for example, discloses that they're having suicidal thoughts or something like that, then it's really, really important that you as a teenager don't have to deal with that, and that you come to a safe adult and talk it through. But if your friend wants to talk to you about, you know, what happened at a party on Saturday night, and I think that that's great. It's building meaningful, positive relationships, which are really important for human thriving.
Absolutely. So Glenn, you mentioned something before in passing, and I want you to just elaborate on that.
Sure.
Do you see tangible benefits just by reaching out? So obviously sometimes when someone sees a psychologist, they go through therapy, they go through a whole process of healing, but you don't do therapy really, you just are on the other end of the phone and where people reach out in emergency situations. Do you see benefits to that itself?
Absolutely. And again, like we're, and just a slight distinction, like we're not quote unquote a crisis call center. We offer brief support and we will make referrals, but we're going to hold that space and honor it and make sure that they're safe, most importantly. And then, you know, maybe gently try to settle them and move them on. But the benefits of reaching out are just incredible. I mean, if I could tell you how many calls I've gotten in the past where they're like, "This is the first time I've ever reached out before. I've never been able to do this." And if hopefully they get a counselor like myself or some of my other terrific colleagues at this job and just validate their experience and the nerves and the strength that it took to do that, I think it changes the whole dialogue they have with themselves. They're like, wait a second, you know, I was keeping this to myself this whole time. I thought I was this and this and this, and this person is telling me that it's absolutely okay that I could do this, that I have permission to be feeling the way I'm doing. That opens up a whole new possibility of getting further help like that. So absolutely not. It doesn't matter what. When you reach out, I think it's, look, it. We know climbing, going up takes more effort than going down. It takes effort to pull yourself up. When you reach out, you're pulling yourself up. But when we pull ourselves up, we're working muscles that we didn't know we had. Constantly on our lines, we're constantly validating that, saying, I'm so glad you called. And I never get tired of saying that to people. It really rings very true.
Wow. Dee, you want to add something for that?
I just want to say that, you know, continuing with that, Sonia Lubomowski, who's a really great psychologist, positive psychologist, done a lot of work on research on happiness. And she actually says that the happiest people feel a sense of belonging. They feel as if they have what she calls, it's a lovely word, actually, she says, close proximity to people, that you've got people near you. And she says that that is really the hallmark of happy people, that happy, successful people have got that. And I just want to say, in our community, how lucky are we? Because there is almost like an inbuilt sense of belonging. I know you can hear my South African accent, which will never get lost. And, well, you know, we emigrated, and first we went to live in Vancouver. And what was the first thing we did? We went to shul on a Friday night, and there were all people there, and they were like, oh, you knew, you know, whatever. And then we came to Sydney, and we went into a Jewish day school with our kids, and it was like a built-in sense of, oh, you know what? I can reach out and ask people things because I belong. And I think that that is such an important thing for people to feel, a sense that they are part of something. And it changes actually the way our brain functions when we feel that sense of belonging. It actually changes our neural pathways because we feel happiness.
Well, Ty, you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, once talking about that, so let's just share this perspective. People are wired for connection. People need connection. Now, just to throw in a bit of a Jewish perspective there, we know that at the very beginning of creation, when God created the world, so Adam was created alone. And the very, very famous verse is that God said, "Lo tov v'yot Adam levado." It's not good for a person to be alone. I'm going to make him a soulmate, right? But the word levado can be translated differently. I think it was Rabbi Soloveitchik that said it. There's alone and there's lonely. Because I'm just following on from what Dee said. I mean, the power of connection is amazing. The power of belonging is so important. But the power of belonging needs work. It doesn't always mean just because there's people around, people belong, right? People can be isolation, as we know from COVID, particularly isolation is very negative. But isolation doesn't always mean being physically alone or not having people to talk to. Isolation means not being able to make a connection. And I think it's a bit of a two-way street. I mean, when you said you went to shul and someone said, oh, you're new here, are you okay? That's also, it takes effort on both sides. It takes effort to want to belong and to put in the effort to belong. Sometimes people don't belong because they don't put in the effort, but also on the other side, it takes effort from everyone. It's a communal responsibility to make sure that there is a sense of belonging. That we reach out to people, and if we see someone new, and if we don't see someone for a while, to give them a call or whatever the case is, it's about investing in belonging, because otherwise people can actually, sense of belonging is so critical, but just bearing in mind that belonging can be, you can be in a crowd and still be very lonely. And that's what it was meant, I think, when God said this, it's not good for a person to be alone, not just physically alone, but not, as Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out, it's very bad for a person to be lonely. I mean, to build a relationship, as we said before, to build connection.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is an interesting question. I actually don't know the answer to this, and I don't know where this will go, but I just want to throw it out there. I'm just actually interested to know the answer to this, and anyone can answer this. Do you find that women reach out for help more than men, or do men reach out for help more than women? Is there a stigma for men reaching out? Does that still exist? I'm just interested to know if that... Yeah, Glenn, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I could just speak to, again, just based on my experience, and yeah, I do tend to get more female callers, but fortunately, it seems like over the last year, I'm getting male callers. Like men as a whole have a higher rate of suicide than women. I know that's statistically true. So women tend to, but I do find that when the men do reach out, they're so relieved, you know, they've just given themselves that permission to have that connection like that as well too. And certainly when I get a gentleman on the line and they hear a gentleman on the other line, it helps as well too. And I'll defer to them and I'll say, hey, look, I get it. I know what it's like to be in this dark place. I understand what it's like to feel, you know, as a male, you have to be kind of tough and in control of the emotions and everything. And to let go of that and to just give yourself permission to feel that bit, it goes such a long way. So yes, women tend to call more, but I've been finding certainly I'm very hopeful to see that we're normalizing mental health, we're normalizing depression and anxiety, and we're quote unquote normalizing suicidal thoughts, times when you just don't feel like being here. That's certainly one of the best things that I think that's been coming out of this whole mental health wave and recognition. I mean, it's the Are You Okay Day, right? When, as the rabbi said, you know, it's not just up to the person to reach out to the community. It's up to the community to reach out to the person as well, too.
Absolutely. Do you find my students that boys are more hesitant to come?
So traditionally, I think that, as Glenn said, he's correct, like women kind of reach out, you know, more. But that's why, especially at Moriah, but at all schools, part of well-being programs is actually to educate young people and educate them into things, as I said, the help-seeking behavior, and also breaking down the stigma. Like our psychology offices are like in the middle of the school. Gone are the days where the psychologists are, you know, at the back of the school and people creep around. And we're breaking that stigma because we're saying to kids in all the well-being programs and our positive ed programs, we're saying, if you've got concerns, if you have strong feelings about things, if you have fears, it's normal to want to talk about them. Come and find a safe adult in the school to talk. And so what we're finding is that we kind of like breaking that tradition, and we have as many boys as girls that come to talk, but it's a process. And I think that if we started in schools, can you imagine if it starts in all schools early on? I think then men and women will equally come and reach out. But I agree with what Glenn said. There definitely still is that stigma. Often men, I don't want to be gender specific, but often men will say, you know, oh, I got to man up, or I can't express my feelings. And that's really, really not true. And we need to break it down at a level of young boys. And actually a man is someone who acknowledges their feelings and is willing to take that risk and ask for help.
Absolutely. Ty, do you have any experience?
No, just interesting. Max, we've all got different experiences here, but I think there's a common theme. I mean, you definitely see that people who reach out, it seems to be, it is changing. I think it is changing. I see that myself as well. Mm-hmm. You know, people that talk to me, but it is changing, but definitely more difficult for men. I think one reason is what we just said, if I could throw just a little Kabbalistic idea here. One reason is because men sort of have this perception that you've got to be strong and tough and so on, which, you know, sometimes reaching out is a strength and not reaching out as a weakness, but they need to understand that, which is part of their education. But also it's the ability of how to express it. And, you know, they say women are better, without stereotyping, but the feminine energy is better at communicating, right? Which is Kabbalistically true. There's a whole concept of where the feminine energy comes from and the masculine energy comes from, and the concept of malchut, which is dibur, communication, is certainly a much more feminine concept. And therefore it's about also not only about having the strength to reach out, it's also maybe giving people the words, like it's, you know, what to say and how to express yourself, and or it's okay not to express yourself so coherently. It's okay just to reach out and just share the way you can. But what I found is that that's a problem, because sometimes men, even when they do reach out, they reach out much later. Like they carry the stuff until it explodes. And it's a pity, because sometimes you can deal with stuff a lot earlier. It's better, obviously stronger. But it is changing. I think it is changing. That's a good thing.
Okay. So this has been mentioned a few times, and I want to just sort of move on to the idea of connections more. So we've spoken about reaching out and the importance of it. So it's been mentioned a few times already that having good connections can help someone either prevent or alleviate mental health struggles. But I think it is fair to say that even people who do have connections struggle with their mental health. Many people who are married struggle with their mental health, and people who have good friends struggle with mental health. So I'm interested in knowing, number one, is it do you find that people who reach out statistically sort of more of them have less friends or less connections in their life? Or do you see that actually, no, that doesn't actually make much of a difference? Glenn, you want to?
Well, again, I'm happy to jump in. And again, it's just based on my perspective, because again, we are, as I said, we're like that first line of defense. We're sometimes the first people that people have ever connected to. And yes, I mean, look, it's interesting because today we were just trained in a whole risk assessment training, and we were kind of talking about strength-based approach, though. And the one thing that we do ask people is, what are your connections? Like, who is somebody that you could reach out to? It's a safety plan. And just as a side, there's a wonderful app called Beyond Now, which is free and you could download, and it's a safety plan. And one of the questions it asks is, who can you reach out to? Who is there for you? So yes, for many people, they don't have those connections. Other than like a friend, like one random friend or somebody, they have nobody who they've been to before. So for them not to have that, that's a big precursor towards them calling in the first place. And what we'll try to do is remind them that, hey, you know, you do have that in place. Let's talk about who you went to when you were in a bad place before. So I guess, is that kind of what you're at? You know, I mean, we get more people who unfortunately are isolated and not alone, but lonely, as the rabbi said.
Yeah, definitely. Dee, do you find sometimes, just to add to the question for sort of in your context, do you find that by teenagers, sometimes the connections themselves can be the ones causing the problems? Is that a thing?
Absolutely. But once again, let's look at what you mean by connection, because for teenagers, sometimes connections could be the number of likes they have, like on their, you know, Instagram, Snapchat, I don't know, I can never keep up with what the latest social media, but you know, and what does that mean? That's not really a connection. A connection is, again, an authentic, meaningful relationship. So what we try and do, because remember, in a school level, we really want to work preventatively. That's the most important thing. We want to try and give them, you know, as many tools as possible, because there's a huge correlation between well-being and mental health. And if you look at what we try and teach is the PERMA model. So Martin Seligman, positive psychology, and I keep going back to that, but it is, as Glenn said, strength-based. It's like a boost for your well-being and your mental health. What do we teach our students? We teach our students on PERMA that people who have a lot of happiness in their life, people who do well in their life, actually feel positive emotion. They consciously feel positive emotions. So what do? They will feel gratitude. They will go out and they will tell people, I'm grateful. They will, before they go to bed at night, they might write a gratitude journal, or they'll consciously think about what they're grateful for. They'll engage in their life. People with good mental health and well-being will want to engage. They'll wake up in the morning and think, what should I be doing? How can I do this? And they'll be actively the partnering and engaging. They'll have good relationships, which we've spoken about, those meaningful ones. And they'll look for meaning and purpose in their life. They feel as if whatever they want to do in their day, there's got to be a little bit of meaning and purpose in that. And finally, that they feel accomplished at any stage of your life, right from when you're young till, you know, retirement and beyond. You should have a sense of that during the day you are accomplishing things, you're doing things. And people that actually engage in the PERMA model and you engage in those things are happier and more successful, and their well-being is increased, and they flourish. So that's what we try to teach kids, is to learn those skills so that they can kind of like boost themselves and boost their mental health and well-being.
Yeah. How do you find?
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts. So first of all, you talk about connections. Dee mentioned about what's the definition of a connection. It's certainly not likes on Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok, or whatever the case is. Unfortunately, that's not meaningful connections, but I think what's happened is people often diminish their real connections because they're hiding behind the superficial and the false connections. Building up this whole profile, building up a positive profile on social media and getting lots of likes. In the meantime, they're not actually investing in real connection. And the reason for that is because real connection actually takes effort. You know, just if we can pick up on this for a moment, from a Torah perspective, from a Jewish perspective, the whole creation of the world, if you look in the way the Torah develops from Genesis onwards, from Reshit onwards, the whole creation of the world is built on relationships. Relationships which take effort, relationships which allow us to grow, right? Growth is critical to the human development. Both growth brings inner fulfillment, brings happiness. It's the person constantly growing and giving meaning to their life. The way that happens is to be able to go beyond ourselves, and beyond ourselves meaning means to be able to go beyond ourselves and connect to others. If I'm not mistaken, there's so much research about being kind to others, bringing so much meaning, and being kind to others, bringing a whole new level of health and well-being. Just the acts of kindness, acts of going out of ourselves, acts of doing for others, not being trapped and self-absorbed, that in itself contributes to well-being. Because really what that leads to from a Jewish perspective is that the ultimate relationship is going out of ourselves and connecting to something higher, connecting to God. Connecting to God, and by connecting to God is to bring that whole level of meaning and purpose into our lives. We know that meaning and purpose is, I mean, this is Viktor Frankl stuff, but obviously it's very, very Torah-based. Meaning and purpose is what brings stronger well-being. Now, you mentioned an interesting little question there. You know, does that mean anyone who has a connection won't suffer from mental health challenges? I think the answer is no. I think everyone can, just like any sickness can strike anyone who's very healthy. But definitely is very preventative. But besides being a prevention, I think also when someone has deep connections, if they are struck by a challenge, by a trauma, by physiological imbalances which cause depression or anxiety, whatever the case is, the connection will also not only will at that point also serve, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the deep connections and healthy connections, true connections, ones that have come with effort and investment, will also serve as a support for the healing process. I mean, people who have good, healthy relationships and connections, when they do get struck by a mental health challenge, which no one's immune to and everyone can be, that support will be tremendously helpful and beneficial and contribute to the healing journey and process, I think.
Absolutely.
Great. Yeah, for sure. You all mentioned social media. I want to talk about social media a little bit, because I think this is, I think, probably one of the biggest problems of today's day and age with kids. You know, when I sat with Dee at Mariah, we actually asked the kids themselves why they feel these bad feelings, and literally they all started saying social media. And then the question was, why are you on social media? And I don't remember what, I don't know if there it was a satisfactory answer there. I saw a very, actually it was like, I was watching a video on YouTube, and sometimes there's like these ads that come up before. I think it was like actually a Beyond Blue ad or one of these sort of mental health ads. And it said a statistic there that 12-year-old girls are adding filters to their pictures on social media now because of pressure, because they need to look perfect. Those who don't know what filters are, filters can change the way you look, make you look quote unquote better. I think probably nothing should shock you anymore, but it is shocking. It is shocking that, you know, such young girls are, you know, sort of, they're so pressured to look perfect on social media that they're using filters. I think it's like that with everything. This pressure to portray a perfect life on social media. So what damage is that doing? Can we fix this? Is there, like, can we walk backwards? Can we go back 20 years where we don't have these things, or it's just here to stay? So what are we doing about it?
I mean, I'm happy to talk to just briefly. Again, I'm sure Dee has a good perspective, you know, being in the school system, but I have had, you know, the pleasure, whatever you want to call it, but I've had the opportunity to speak to many kids too. And yes, it is. I think it's almost like it's like a Pavlovian response. You know, you get that like, you feel good. You get that like, you feel good. And it's just like this quick fix, this quick reinforcement like that. And who doesn't like to feel good quickly? It's almost like a dopamine surge. And I think that's true for all of us. I mean, I think we're all guilty of that. Adults, we put up pictures of our vacations, and we like it when people like it. When people like our stuff, we feel like they like us as well, too. And we have to realize, yes, while that's nice, it's still only going to last. It's not going to last that long. That's the problem. And that's why you keep going back for that hit over and over again. So I think that's terrific, though, that kids are aware of it now, though. I mean, this, the self-awareness, the key is to try to retrain them. It's sort of like saying, okay, this isn't the only place to get your short-term fix. There are longer term fix. There are long strength-based relationships that are going to have ebb and flows. So the more we could at least make them aware that this is what the feedback is and this is what you're doing, hopefully that gets them a little bit of a sense like, okay, I know this is just temporary. It's not what I really need to keep myself going for the big haul.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to
So you know, you speak about 12-year-old girls with filters, but if you look at the bigger picture, where is that coming from? It's coming from our society, because our society is photoshopping models on runways and making women look unrealistic, okay, or making them look a way that most women actually don't look, and that is what girls are actually looking at. That's their role models. So I think that that is all happening, and I think that sometimes it can be really frustrating when trying to change all of that. How can we change it? I think we've got to be realistic about social media, because there are really good things of social media and there's bad things. Just like most things in life, there's two parts to it. There's good things. It keeps people connected. Look at what we're doing tonight. We're all sitting in our own homes and we're learning and talking, and there's beautiful things, you know, that this creates. And I do see kids that use it to spread kindness and be aware and learn things. And so that's what we've got to kind of help them to focus on. And in terms of the negative, we're always talking about social media in terms of how it can be hurtful or harmful, and how we need to teach our children to be upstanders, not bystanders, that if they see people going through a difficult time on social media, that they need to report it or they need to get off. Parents can definitely set limits and boundaries, sometimes very, very tricky. I have, my older two are not teenagers, thank goodness, but I do have one teenager left. It's tricky. It's really, really tricky. I think the thing that we can do is be good role models. And also, again, let's go back to what the topic is, connection. If you have a connection with your children and you open up that dialogue and you're interested and you're authentic and you talk to them, they will come to you when things happen and they'll be able to talk through a lot of that stuff, even when they're teenagers. And one last thing I want to say, it was really interesting because every year Mission Australia does a youth survey. Okay, so they survey all the youth in around Australia. And you can go online if anyone's interested, missionaustralia.com.au, have a look at their youth survey, like what are the concerns and what are their values? And then we do it at school. So they give us a Mariah kind of little snapshot. And it's interesting because Mariah kids actually wrote this last 2021 that the thing that they value the most is family relationships. Mm-hmm. Which was, I said to the parents, that's music to, you know, for a psychologist, that's music to our ears. Because what they are saying is that they feel connected, that they feel involved. And so that can be like an antidote that can really help all the harmful, hurtful things, that they have an avenue of connection. So keep those connections open with your kids, talk to them. And also, sorry, one last thing is have empathy. You know what, guys? It's really tricky being a teenager in today's age, much trickier than when I was a teenager. Everything's happening quickly. They know if they're not at a party, they're seeing the party happen. It's hard to be a teenager, and sometimes just having empathy and opening up conversations is really a good thing.
I can just follow up.
That's incredible.
A couple of things that you mentioned, and Glenn. So, Levi, you said, you know, what can we do about it? Can we go back 20 years? Obviously, the answer is no, we can't. Not only we can't because it's not practical, actually, philosophically, we can't. You know, we have a principle in Judaism that everything happens for a reason, and every technological advancement or discovery is actually divinely inspired. It's how we use it that's good or bad, but intrinsically, it's good. Dee said that we're sitting here tonight on Zooms, we're all in our home, we're using technology. We're actually, for those who aren't aware, we're being live streamed on social media at the moment. So it's not like, right? We're using it. We use social media all the time, right? However, it comes with its real challenges. So just to share a couple of thoughts on that. Everything, a lot of things in this world, a lot of things that we either think are positive or negative, have a positive or negative side to it. And very often, and I think this is true with technology and lots of other things, but particularly with technology in general, very often the barometer, in other words, the sign, the indicator, if it's good or bad, is who's controlling who. Are we controlling the technology, or is the technology controlling us? Unfortunately, in many cases today, technology controls people because it's very addictive, whether it's social media, whether it's just looking at that scrolling and surfing the net and looking at YouTube videos or the YouTube app, whatever the case is, it's very addictive and it starts to take over our lives. Inevitably, it's going to be negative then. In fact, I saw a shocking study that since you know smartphones have come into being, Dean mentioned empathy. In general society, empathy has dropped because people aren't paying attention. They're absorbed, they're self-absorbed, and they're absorbing their devices. And they're not paying attention to other people. They're not noticing what's happening to other people. But at the same time, it has so much good. I mean, Jewish wisdom, for example, the dissemination of Judaism today through technology and even through social media is phenomenal. Never in history has Torah learning, for example, just to use an example in this context, been so accessible as it is today, which is a great thing. Why am I saying all that? Because I think, and Dee alluded to this, I think that when you say, what can we do about it? It's not just about what kids can do about it, it's about what we do about it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'd like to emphasize is that I think what we can do about it is we need to build a culture very early on from young children, but can only be done if we show an example of self-control. You know, if we have kids at home and we're sitting at a supper table with the phone and looking at and checking the WhatsApps, we cannot expect them to not be resistant when we try to limit their usage. Right now, of course, we can use it at different levels than they can. Of course, children are children, parents are parents, but we have a very loose sense of delayed gratification and self-control generally in today's society. And really it's up to us adults to actually start building a culture of self-control, because whether technology is going to control us or we're going to control technology has to do with our choices and our ability to limit ourselves and to make good decisions. So when we take out our kids to play in a park, we need to not look at the phone. When we go out to a restaurant with friends, we need to not look at the phone. All these type of things, right? We need to build that culture of self-control, use the good, but it's actually urgent. We actually do need to do something about it. It's not even a religious issue about content, about what we're looking at. It's actually just a society issue, and it's very destructive. But we can channel it. We can teach kids from very young age the art of us controlling it rather than it controlling us.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's not only social media. I mean, social media is a big part of it, but I think it's technology in general. Mm-hmm. Movies, videos, games, online games, all these things. I think it doesn't make you feel good afterwards. It doesn't produce good, positive feelings. Would you agree with that?
It's like Glenn said before, it's a quick fix, but it's not a work. Yeah. It doesn't bring long-term inner fulfillment at all.
Yeah.
It's like any kind of addiction, Levy. Sorry, it's like any kind of addiction. Might give you something in the moment, but actually, it long term, it's not really fulfilling, you know, kind of anything. So it is. It's kind of the same sort of process.
It's like I saw a child walking the other day with a book. Like it was a child that I knew who it was.
Wow.
So I was like, wow, that's incredible. I was like, keep on going. It's like, who does that nowadays? Walking with a book. That's a much more constructive thing. I would love to hear, this is more of a personal question, because we're talking about the power of reaching out, and all three of you are on the other end of people reaching out to you. That could itself be very overwhelming and draining. I'm young, just sort of starting out in this job, and I know that from the very few people that have reached out to me, sometimes afterwards you feel like, you feel like not okay yourself. So I'm just interested to know how you deal with that on a personal basis. How do you keep yourself strong?
I'll speak to that in general too, because like you said, like parents get flooded all the time and they're flustered that they can't help their kids. And I tell them, look, you know, you can't help a child breathe if you're unable to breathe yourself. Self-care is so, so important with this. With our job in particular, we happen to have a terrific network of support there. They encourage us that if we had a particularly difficult call, step out, debrief, talk it through with somebody. And at the end of the day, let it go. Like tune in, tune off, drop out. Like do a nice, you know, instant Shabbat for yourself or something where you just shut everything down completely like that. So I just try to say to myself, I've done the best I can. I've left it out on the table, but I'm not going to take this with me right now. And I'll just make it a point and then I'll connect with friends, a girlfriend, my son, you know, et cetera. Just go to those reinforcements that make me feel good about myself again as well too. Because yes, the offloadee needs to offload from time to time. And if you can't do that, then you're just gonna sail into a big burnout. So you always have to monitor that as well too. So look after yourself. All right, do so.
Absolutely. Dee, what's your experience? Yeah. With that?
So I think that, you know, as you become more experienced, and what you learn is actually a beautiful mindfulness technique, and that is when I'm seeing someone or someone is with me, I am absolutely present with that person and in that moment. And I give them everything that I've got in that moment. And then when they kind of leave my office, I actually allow myself to let it go. That they now, I put them into the world, they're going into the world, and I'm, you know, getting on with what I need to do. And I think what Glenn said, self-care is absolutely essential. Of course, we're all human, you know, even after doing this for, you know, nearly 30 years, there are times when people come and share such painful things with you that of course you carry that a little bit, but I've learned to kind of like let that go. And when I'm with them the next time, I'm fully present with them, because otherwise what happens is, and Glenn said it, you actually then burn out and you can't do, and you know, then you can't really do what you meant to do. So it's very important to take time and to practice self-care. And what I find the best for that is mindfulness, meditation, breathing. And we actually have a beautiful mindfulness class that Rabbi has taught in with me for year 11. And I have to get you, Levi, we have to bring you that's our next move. But that's what we teach them. We teach them to be present in the moment. And then, you know, it's very, very helpful.
Absolutely. Ty, you want to comment on that?
I'll just share with you something interesting. Just reflection. So in my sort of journey as a rabbi in the community, one of my role models, who's no longer alive, but one of my role models I'll always reflect back on and try to learn from was my grandfather, who was a very famous rabbi in South Africa, Rabbi Eloy. And he was a person, one of his greatnesses was he had tremendous, tremendous connection with people. So much so when I got a bit older and I moved to Sydney and lots of South Africans came here and a lot of them knew him, I used to hear from so many different people that he was there, either there or their fathers or their aunts or their uncle's best friend. I always wondered, how can a person have so many best friends? But he used to really connect with people. And one of the things I've really heard people is that he would, if you went to someone's simcha, it was like his simcha. If you went to someone's tragedy, it was like his tragedy. He was really participated. So on the one hand, especially as a rabbi, that's really, really important. But I always wondered, like, how did he, I because this question you're asking is a very, very good question. And I thought about it when the question became relevant to me, I thought back to him. And I remember that Sundays was always his very, very busy day. In the morning, he was at the cemetery doing lots of consecrations and unveilings and things that they call them there. And then in the afternoon, he always had like a few weddings. I mean, in his high time in the shul, there was like 150 weddings a year. But I realized looking back and observing it, I remember that he was very careful. He was not two things. He was very careful, not self-care in a self-centered way to be over needy, but he always like took a rest and he always would make sure he ate properly and was organized with his life so he would be strong. And the other thing is that he had an inner love of life, and he sort of had this sense of humor, and he would make jokes. And if it wasn't, I'll give you like I once asked him, you know, we once talked about education and college education. Now he came from the shtetl. He never didn't have an HSC or a university degree. Anything, but he was a great person. So he say, I've got a PhD. I said, Zayda, what do you mean you got a PhD? So he said, yeah, I've got a PhD. I'm a perfect Hesped deliverer, because he was known for his amazing eulogies, right? So he would never make a joke if it was a personal thing about someone, but sometimes he would just make a joke about things that he does just to lighten up a little bit I remember that. It was just interesting. Yeah.
Okay. I want to just, first of all, if anyone has any questions, please put it in the chat. Just we'll end off with one more question. And if anyone has any questions, please put it in the chat. It's a similar type of question as before, but sort of more for other people. What is the best way to be there for people who are closest to us? So if we have a spouse going through a hard time, a child going through a hard time, a friend going through a hard time, what is, and we're talking about someone who's not professional. So I'm not professionally trained to deal with that. What's the best thing that person can do? What is their role in that process of healing?
I'm happy to speak to that a little bit. I mean, and I think Dee referred to it too. It's genuine empathy. It's not being there to necessarily fix the problem, because we can't fix the problem as much as we want to, especially when it's someone that we love, we care about. We want to just fix it right away. But we could say, hey, I'm with you in this moment right now. I get you're in a bad place, and you could stay in that bad place with me. It's okay to be there right now. It's like we talked about, it's being fully present with that individual, you know, looking at them and saying, I get it. I hear your pain. I do feel it. Well, not necessarily feel it, but I could understand what that pain is about, because sometimes we make that mistake and say, I know what you're going through, or I, you know, it's like, no, I understand those feelings. I'll often say that to callers. I may not be going through that same experience, but I could understand that feeling of anxiety, that feeling of hopelessness. So I get it. So when you're with them, they know it. And when they feel safe, that means they're going to continue to just simply be with you. It's being present with them and being uncomfortable with that bit of silence, and having them being comfortable with that uncomfortable moment, and having them feel the same way.
Absolutely.
Can I just jump in there? I think one of the things which we can all improve on, and it's a continuous journey. You say what the best way to be there for someone is. I think one word that comes to mind, I mean, many things come to mind. One of the things that comes to mind for me is the art of noticing. Being aware. And what's amazing is that sometimes the people who are closest to us, we notice the least for some reason, because we're just so used to them. You know, maybe they have a bad day once in a while, but then again, everyone can have a bad day. But it's noticing the difference between a regular bad day or something that's really troubling someone. You know, you can be in shul and then it won't be someone who comes every single day, and then it doesn't come all of a sudden, or she doesn't come. That's easy to notice. But someone who you live with, for example, or someone, it could be a child, it could be a sister, it could be a parent, it could be anything. It could be someone to be close to, or a friend that we see often. The just being aware, like to think about, like, is this person seems a bit different, off color, or they haven't been the same lately, or they're not eating properly, or whatever the case is. That art of noticing is something, and that's being aware. It's about being, you know, I think it comes back to mindful living as well, to pay attention, noticing details, just being aware. So we can pick up, and then we in the position to ask the question, like, are you okay? Or is everything all right? Or I see things aren't, you know, something's bothering you. Would you like to share? Or maybe they don't want to share, but at least you care. At least that empathy, you care. But the empathy is born out of noticing.
For sure. And I think going back to the social media and technology, a lot of the reason why we don't notice what's going on around us is because a lot of us are just looking at our phones all day, and it's actually very difficult to really notice what's actually going around you, and even in your own house, just to notice, it could be a very big obstacle to that. Dee, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, just think that if you're asking, like, from even a non-professional, if you are a parent or a friend or whatever, and as Rabbi said, you can actually verbalize and say to someone, I've just noticed the last few weeks that things, you just seem not to be yourself, and I'm really concerned about you, and I just want you to know that I'm here for you to talk to. I'm safe, and you know, whenever you need me. Just that person knowing that someone said that you're naming it, that you're saying it, can be so freeing, because a person sitting with, you know, a lot of stuff. And I say that to kids as well. I feel like, as a therapist, it's a privilege. People allow me to go into their world, and they share things that are very, very sacred. And I use the word sacred in a, you know, mindfully. It's a huge privilege. And I just think that it's really important that people feel that you're there for them, that they can share things with you, that it's confidential, and that you can point them in the right direction as well. So I sometimes think for parents, you know, Levi, you spoke earlier about old fashioned. Can we go back to old fashioned, or, you know, can we go back to where we were? I'll tell you where I think, I agree we can't go back, but I'll tell you where those things are so important is in family relationships. If you are part of a family, you can actually see that, hold on, you know what? I want my family to sit around a table. Maybe it won't work out every night because everyone's busy, but at least for Shabbat or twice a week, that we all sit together and we talk to each other. Those are not old-fashioned values. Those are really, really important things that we should be doing. Spending quality time. It's difficult as a parent to spend time with your kids. You know, everyone's running and soccer practice and this and that, but make the time. Say to one of your, each of your kids, you know what? I'm going to actually spend on Thursday after school or whatever. I'd really like to go with you and just let's go get something to drink and I can spend that time. It's not about the quantity. It's really about the quality. So if you can, what you're doing then, if you're creating that quality time, you're telling your children and you're telling your family, I'm here for you. I'm here to listen to you. And that opens them up to then seek help when they need to.
Well, that's, yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining. Thank you so much, Dee. Thank you so much, Glenn, for taking the time to be together with us. We will be continuing the series next week, Wednesday night, same time, same link, with Renee Mill. Tati, you want to describe the topic of next week?
I think we're going to go sort of just into, I mean, people often have to refer to people who are professionals, but we're going to talk about the concept of intervention, a bit more about prevention, but like the different types of interventions there are and, you know, what type of people should be seeing and around that journey, the journey of healing.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining. And someone asked, how can you show someone this recording? We'll be putting it on Bina's website, bina.com.au. Bina is B-I-N-A.
Or if you want, you can email the office, office@bina.com.au and ask for the recording and you'll get it.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks. See you.
Good night. Bye. Good night.